and see. She's nice, he said, but she's a little dull, you know, not much curiosity. She's young. No excuse. Anyone can read a book, you know. I don't get it. All these people who just want to stay on the island summer after summer. Don't they want to see the world, do new things, meet new people? Is that what you want to do? He picked up another stone and turned it over, hefted it, bent sideways to send it skidding forcefully out to sea. He had an easy swing to his arm, like a boy who played baseball or football. Feel like I'm going to explode sometimes, he said. Just kerpow. You know what I thought last night, standing there on the ferry? I thought I might want to just dive overboard and swim to shore and, I don't know, get in a car and drive west. South, north, anything but Greyfriars. Mom with her paints and Isabel with her fucking knitting. Ah, jeez, I'm sorry. Oh, I've heard worse, believe me. I love them, I do. They mean the world to me, but I used to watch you up there on that movie screen and think, how did she do it? How did she escape? I had help from a friend, for one thing. Isabel's mother helped me. When the papers came out and nobody else would speak to me, not even Isabel and Mama, she picked me up in her car and took me straight to New York. We sailed to Paris the next day, on the old Île-de-France. But only because you dared. You took a stand against them. He nodded to the left, in the direction of the club. You know how the Fishers got in, don't you? The founders wouldn't let them buy one of the original plots in the development, the ones around the club. So my grandfather picked up that whole section on the southern end, overlooking the lighthouse, used to be a farm, and built Greyfriars. And they ignored him for a couple of years until the crash hit, and Peter Dumont nearly went under. He'd invested in some risky securities, it turned out, and nobody had the bread, liquid, I mean, to bail him out. Nobody but good old August Fisher. I started to laugh. Is that so? I never knew. Poor Peter, how humiliating. That's what Mr. Monk told me once. So you really can buy your way into the Winthrop Island Club. And once you're in, you're in. You couldn't get out if you tried. He held up his arms to the sky. One more year. One more year of school and I'm free. What about college? What about college? Aren't you going to Harvard like your father? Not me. Another 4 years of all this? No way, Jose. I'm not going to college, Miranda. I'll be 18 years old by then. I've got plans. What kind of plans? I've been saving up, caddying every summer, going to sell my old ragtop and buy myself a sailboat and take off for a whole year. He picked up another stone and examined it for seaworthiness. Promise you won't tell Mom, though. She's got her heart set on, I don't know, me following in Dad's footsteps, being the fellow he was supposed to be, winning back all the dough he lost, so she and Isabel can, you know, all that. He waved his hand once more in the direction of the club. And you don't want that? Heck no, I want to see the world. I want to do what you did. Acting? Well, you've got the looks for it, I suppose. He dropped the stone in his hand and picked up another. Shucks, sis, I don't want to act. I want to be. I want to do. I want to... Well, like I said, you'll find out. Next spring. Just watch. What? Nothing. You remind me of someone, that's all. He threw the stone, a decent toss, 4 or 5 skips, and picked up another one. Now you tell me something. What's that? Why did you come back? And don't tell me you were bored or between films or anything like that. I was bored, I said. I was between films. He threw the stone, but it didn't take. Sank without a trace at the second bounce. Hugh swore and shook his head, staring at the black, lapping sea, hands on hips. When he turned back to me, he was grinning from one side of his mouth. So maybe you've come back to save us, have you? Stir up the pot, get Mom and Isabel to put on their glad rags and have dinner at the club, hire a few builders to patch up Greyfriars and throw a great big party? That's not a bad idea. But it's not the real reason, is it? Maybe I just wanted to see you. Maybe I wanted to visit my mother and sister and brother after all these years. Heal the wounds. That's a nice story, he said, but I'm not buying it. Why this summer, of all summers? Was it Vargas? No, of course not. Oh, come on. It's true. I didn't find out about... I didn't know he'd escaped until after I'd decided to leave England. So what was it? What's the tale, Nightingale? I opened my mouth to make some snappy remark, some denial of the obvious, but his face was absolutely earnest as he looked down at me, like the face of a 30-year-old, and I remembered he had no father. He was a boy with no father who stood on the edge of manhood, and this was something we shared. The two of us, we knew how that void in your heart, that father-shaped hole, might lead you down paths of terrible sorrow in search of something to fill it. Okay, I know it's not the Winthrop way, he said. We don't ask questions. We pretend everything's just fine and then drink ourselves to death, or get murdered by the son of the lighthouse keeper for some reason nobody on this damned island is ever going to talk about. I put my arms around my brother's back and drew him close, and I felt the comfort of his own arms around my waist holding me there, the beat of his enormous heart. He smelled of cigarettes and soap and green youth, of everything lost. When I opened my eyes again, the sea lay before me, over the crest of his shoulder. I thought if I tried, I could peer across the tip of Long Island and see all the way to England. I came because I lost a baby, I said. The jolt of shock went right through his middle. I had to clamp my arms to keep him from jumping apart. Oh, sis, oh my God, when? In the accident. I was about 6 months along. They couldn't save her. Her, said Hugh. It was a girl. Geez, my niece. Yes. So what about your husband? Why isn't he here with you? Hugh loosened his arms and pulled away to look down at me, and this time I let him. My God, he does know about it, doesn't he? Of course he knows about it, I said. He was driving the car. 10. Naturally, I didn't tell him the whole story. How could I tell him everything, a boy like that? I mean, there were no words anyway, no possible means to express the details of that awful night, the quantity of vodka Carol had drunk, the vile things he had said to me. Besides, why should Hugh believe me? As far as anyone else knew, Carol was a man of urbanity, of sophisticated reserve, a gentleman, a genius. Certainly not a man given to fits of rage and jealousy, given to consuming on an almost nightly basis a favored, potent mixture of barbiturates and vodka to keep what he was pleased to call his demons at bay. His demons. As if they were something outside himself, something that did not belong to him, but instead tormented the poor, suffering genius and made him do things, Miranda, made him do things he would not ordinarily do. Terrible things, of course, but not things he had himself committed. It was the demons, Miranda. Oh, those demons. Those demons who flew from the netherworld in such power and strength, who assumed control of Carol Goring's body back in April, for example, when we went for drinks to the Mayfair flat of his dear friend Victor. Victor, you see, was celebrating the Academy Award he'd just won for Carol's film The Paradox, Best Actor, as you might recall, for which Carol had also been nominated for Best Director and lost. Carol Goring, as you might also recall, the press certainly makes hay of it in every article and interview, has been nominated for 8 Academy Awards and never taken home the statuette. Now Carol himself was deeply happy for Victor. They share a long and complicated history, Carol and Victor, having once been lovers. But the demons, I understand, were not pleased at all. The demons saw me sitting on the sofa with Victor toward the end of the evening enjoying a laugh, and decided that Victor must be the father of my unborn child, not Carol. After all, Carol had undergone a vasectomy 10 years ago, just before we were married, and therefore there was no possibility whatsoever that he had fathered my child, was there? It must be Victor. There was a terrible fight, a row, as Englishmen call it. Victor went to call the police, and Carol locked the door to the library and forced me on the sofa and pulled up my dress. I told him no and pushed him off and ran for the door, but he caught me and slammed me on my stomach over the sofa arm. The violence of it shocked me. He had never struck me before. His weapons of choice had, until that moment, been words. He didn't actually penetrate me. I don't think he could manage any sort of erection, any genuine sexual arousal, because he'd had too much to drink, too many pills. But his powerlessness only made him more determined to hurt me. I knew at once that something was wrong, that the brutality with which he rammed and rammed, pounding me against the sofa arm in a fruitless pantomime, had done some irreparable damage. I remember trying not to scream, though he seemed to go on forever in a paroxysm of frustration, though the tears ran down my face and onto the dark, stained leather of Victor's sofa. Even now the smell of leather starts a panic inside me. At last he gave up and hauled me downstairs to the empty lobby and out through the service entrance. I didn't make a fuss because of the police, you see, the newspapers and their vicious columns, and because I was so shocked and so battered, so utterly without strength after a difficult pregnancy. I thought I'd let him take me home, and then when he was asleep at last, knocked out by his pills and his vodka and his demons, I would actually leave him this time. He had crossed a final uncrossable line, and I would pack my things and go before he woke up. The car was parked on the corner of Curzon Street. The air was damp and full of fine drizzle that choked me as I tried to hold back my sobs. Carol made sure no one was looking. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, before he threw me in the car and told me more vile things, what a cheap whore I was, how I owed him everything, how I was a fraud, a bimbo with no talent, how he was going to tell the world what I'd done. I kept silent as we swerved around the empty London streets, because I was in terrible pain by now, my insides cramped and cramped. I simply thought I was going to die. There was no point in arguing. Instead of driving to our flat in Kensington, Carol headed straight out of London toward Bath, where we had a country house, keeping up a manic simmering of bile. He described every film we had made together, and each specific instance in which I had disappointed him, each scene I had ruined, so that his failure to win those Academy Awards was really my fault, the sacrifice he had made for my sake, and look how I had repaid him. I knew he hadn't wanted a child. He'd made that clear from the beginning. And I had gone out anyway and slept with Victor, hadn't I? Gotten myself pregnant by Victor. Admit it, Miranda. Just admit it, for God's sake. God damn it, Miranda. Admit that you fucked my friend. Admit you're carrying his child, you bloody tart, you fucking whore. By then, I think I was almost delirious with pain. I would have said anything to make him stop. All right, I screamed back. I admit it. I slept with Victor. I was pregnant by Victor. We started an affair right under your nose during the filming of The Paradox. We carried on right through the premiere and the promotion and the week in Los Angeles for the Oscars. We fucked 2 or 3 times a day. He was insatiable. He was magnificent. He was a god. Carol jerked the wheel once and we careened right off the Bath Road and into a tree. When I woke up, I was in hospital, in a white, dreary room in the middle of Wiltshire, and the baby was dead. Carol, of course, was unharmed and full of remorse. The demons had done it, he said, weeping in my lap. It was the demons. 11. So you see what I mean, how I couldn't tell my green 17-year-old brother about these things. Instead, we lay on the beach side by side and stared up at the dainty stars without speaking. The tide came and went. At one point I rose and clasped my knees, and I thought I saw the white flash of a sail on the horizon. But when I stood up and ran to the edge of the water, it was gone. The house was dark by the time we returned, and as I crept up the back stairs, I couldn't see the shabbiness, the peeling paint and missing bulbs, and I realized that without these signs of decay, Greyfriars felt just the same as it had before, smelled exactly the same. I had the sudden, unnerving conviction that I had traveled through time, that I was creeping up those same stairs as a guilty 17-year-old virgin, afraid of being found out for my transgressions. Then I heard the creak of Hugh's footsteps behind me, and the present world returned, my husband, my dead child, the weight of every year that had passed since I first saw Joseph Vargas dive into the water from his lobster boat and save a man from drowning. We whispered goodnight on the landing, and I slipped into my old bedroom, the one I shared with Brigitte, who snored quietly from her bed. On the window seat was a bowl of roses, the same June roses I had found on my lounge chair that morning, and I went on my knees and stared at them, and the lighthouse that grew between the small pink buds. July 1930. Bianca Madiero. 1. On the 4th of July, in the middle of a tremendous display of fireworks on the lawn, old Mr. Fisher dies. Bianca hears the story of her breakfast the next morning from her cousin Manuelo, who heard it from one of the Fisher housemaids, who's sweet on him. He collapsed with some kind of heart attack, apparently, and because of the darkness, nobody even noticed until after the fireworks were exhausted and the party began to file inside. His wife found him first and began to scream for a doctor, and luckily there was a doctor among that crowd of people, but he came too late. Old Mr. Fisher was already gone. Nobody sees Bianca's face as Manuelo relates this information, between bites of Tia Maria's good sweetbread. Nobody notices how the blood falls away from her cheeks and her lips part in agony. When she rises from the table and begins to clear the plates, hastily and without sound, nobody bothers to thank her. And nobody pays any attention when she slips out the back door afterward and runs along the warm, empty streets toward West Cliff Road. 2. She finds him in the swimming pool, slicing up and down the clear blue rectangle in a businesslike way, like Johnny Weissmuller. She calls his name several times before he interrupts his movements and spins, startled, searching for the source of her voice.
Here, she says, in the boxwoods.
Well, come on out.
Won't they see me?
Mama's had enough pills to knock out a racehorse, and the housemaids won't tell, believe me.
Bianca steps free of the bush and stands, quivering a little, on the terrace that surrounds the pool. The sun's already met the surface, paved in genteel Connecticut bluestone, and its warmth seeps through the soles of her shoes. Hugh holds out his arms.
Come swimming with me.
She shakes her head.
Can't swim.
I'll teach you.
She steps closer.
I'm awfully sorry about your father. I only just heard.
He turns and launches himself back down the length of the pool, but this time he finds the ladder at the end and hoists himself out. He's wearing the latest style of bathing suit, snug and brief, and his chest runs with water. Bianca spins away and starts to cross herself, but before she even touches her right shoulder, her hand falls away to her side.
Drink? Says Hugh.
No, thank you.
Come on, there's plenty. Why are you standing like that?
Bianca feels like a fool and turns. On the other side of the pool, Hugh stands next to a table topped with glass, pouring a drink from a pitcher. No, two drinks, clear as water, into which he drops a pair of lemon slices from a small bowl of cut glass. The sun strikes his shoulders, making them glisten. His hair is sleek and disordered from the water. A small breeze wanders in from the south, smelling of brine, which Bianca inhales in shallow, cautious breaths, as if the air itself contains the raw ingredients of this new mood that shimmers between them. Something is coming to her, some momentous fate. She can feel its approach, like a giant wave, like a thunderstorm tearing across the sky to engulf her.
Well, come here, then. Hugh straightens from the table. I'm not going to bite you, am I?
Strange that he tacked on that question at the end of his declaration, she thinks, but she walks obediently around the end of the pool anyway, conscious of her thin, cheap dress and worn sandals. She stops a couple of yards away, just out of reach, relying on her rigid spine to keep her upright in the face of all that impossible glamour. He holds out one of the glasses.
Here you are. My special recipe.
I don't want it.
Why not?
Because I shouldn't.
Yes, you should. He waggles the glass, making the ice clink. I'm in grief, little one. You've got to go along with my whims.
Bianca reaches out and snatches the glass. In her haste, she spills the contents over her fingers. She lifts her hand and sucks the drops from her skin, and while, of course, she's not exactly expecting water, she's not that innocent. The pungency of it, the sharpness, still stuns her. Hugh observes her actions with a steady, attentive expression.
He holds up his own glass.
To the old man, may he rot in Hades.
Oh, no,
exclaims Bianca.
What's this? Shocked you, have I? Sweet little one. Sweet Bianca. She knows no evil, does she? God protect her darling heart.
He raises the glass again, a little higher this time.
Let's try again. To my dear departed Pater, may his soul, now let me think, may his soul find the eternal reward it so richly deserves. Amen.
His beautiful blue eyes are a little wild, a little pink, and Bianca hesitates.
Little one, he says more softly, it's just gin. It's not going to hurt you, you know. Nothing could hurt you.
She steps forward and gently meets his glass with her own, and she waits until he drinks before she lifts the rim to her lips and sips. The earlier taste has acclimatized her tongue, however, and it's not quite so powerful as she fears. She tries again more deeply, and this time notices the flavor and the peculiar fragrance of the fumes, the scent of juniper berries, and the way the gin burns down her throat and numbs the contours of her brain. Hugh holds himself still, watching her.
What a beauty you are, Bianca. A fresh, marvelous, hypnotic beauty. Your face amazes me every time I see you. Have I ever told you that?
Many times.
Many times, Hugh. Say my name.
Many times, Hugh.
That's better. You say it so well.
He drinks again and takes her hand.
Let's sit down together.
He leads her to the edge of the pool and kneels to remove her sandals one by one. His touch is so cool and so delicate. Bianca shivers in pleasure. When he's done, he sits, dangling his legs into the water, and tugs her down beside him. Not quite close enough to touch, though he keeps her hand in his.
How old were you when you lost your parents, little one? He asks.
I was 3.
I don't even remember them.
It was a plague of some kind, wasn't it?
Yes, the typhoid. I had it too, but I survived. So they sent me to live with Tia Maria and Tio Manuelo, and a year later we came to America. And,
she shrugs her shoulders, because that's all there is to tell, really. She has scarcely any memories of Portugal, just heat and dryness and pungent spicy air, of a wide blue ocean and people of tremendous size. Of course, their great size was only relative to her own childlike frame, but still, she has this idea of Portugal as a land of giants.
Maybe you're lucky, says Hugh. Maybe you never had the chance to learn that your parents were human beings instead of gods.
I don't know. I don't think about them. Tia Maria and Tio Manuelo are like mother and father to me.
They're good to you?
Very good, she says swiftly, firmly.
He lifts her hand and kisses it.
I'm glad to hear that. I won't have my little one mistreated by anybody.
Bianca keeps absolutely still. She knows she ought to be saying something comforting just now, but she can't imagine what. He's lost his father in sudden and terrible circumstances, but Hugh and his father did not share some simple, uncomplicated filial love of the kind she understands. Underneath his skin, he's teeming with the desire to tell her all about it. She can feel this desire. She can sense the awful words roiling in his throat, and she doesn't want to hear them, but she must. If Hugh bears any burden, however grotesque, she must share it with him. It's the only way when you love someone. You must find whatever ugliness there exists within him and have the courage to extract it, like a bad tooth. Or if it cannot be extracted, to actually journey inside him and gather this ugliness in your arms for metamorphosis, by the strength and the purity of your love to make him beautiful again. This she believes with all her heart. The sun beats against their skin side by side. The salt water laps against their legs and stings the pores of Bianca's skin.
Bianca, perhaps
your father, she bursts out. What was he like?
Hugh reaches for the glass of special recipe gin, which rests next to his right thigh, sweating copiously into the stone.
Don't ask. You don't need to know about these things.
Tell me. I want to know. I want to know everything about you.
You already know everything that matters. We're linked, Bianca.
linked by fate and by your beautiful brown eyes. These little details are too small for your notice.
Nothing's too small. If it matters to you, it matters to me.
Believe me, little one.
Believe me, she says fiercely. I can take anything, anything at all, if it belongs to you. We are made from the same soul. You said it yourself.
He finishes the drink and hurls the glass into the boxwoods, where it disappears without a sound. Bianca stares at the tiny, startled leaves, the dark scar where the glass burst through. Hugh's fingers dig into her palm, making her eyes sting with tears. He begins in a casual voice.
He was a drunkard, a philanderer. He used to beat my mother from time to time when she raised any objections. A scoundrel of a businessman, I'm told. Though that's just hearsay, so you can decide for yourself if it's true. He never let me near the company. Sold it last year, took it public. I mean, sold off most of the shares on the stock market, just so I couldn't ever get my hands on the keys of power. I guess he knew what was coming. He saw all these doctors, took all these pills, but a fellow's got to know when his time's running out.
Hugh pauses to kick a little water with his long, strong legs.
When I was young, he used to take out his belt and whip me for any little thing. Any excuse to lay out his rage on some innocent hide that couldn't hit back. He shot my dog dead when I was 9, because it made a mess on the stairs. That's what he was like.
Oh, Hugh, I'm so sorry.
I'm glad he's dead. Hugh drops her hand and scrambles to his feet. I saw his body lying there in the grass last night, and I thought, I hope to God he's dead. I hope to God they can't save him.
By now he's weeping. His shoulders are heaving. His breath comes in terrible spasms.
Do you know what he said to me before he died? His last words? He said, go take that pretty face of yours and find some girl to fuck. That's all you're good for, isn't it? Drinking and fucking.
Bianca jumps up and puts her arms around his waist and lays her head on his shaking chest.
It's all right, Hugh, it's all right. He was wrong. It's all right.
But that's it. He wasn't wrong. God forever damn the bastard, he was dead right. I'm a cad, Bianca. A drunkard and a cad. I'm no good at business. I'm no good for anything.
Bianca, who suspects but isn't quite sure what this word fucking means, still insists,
No, no. There's so much more to you. You're an artist. You're a dreamer. You're 1,000 times better than him. It's all right. You can cry. Come, Hugh. You can be sad and angry both. It's all right.
He wraps his arms around her and weeps into her hair. And she's so happy, absorbing his tears and his grief. Bianca alone among all women, that she knows she ought to cross herself. But her arms are otherwise occupied, holding Hugh with all her might, his bare skin beneath her palms, his scent laying itself upon her, his precious bones and sinews cradled by hers. After a while, he pulls back and tilts her chin up with his finger and starts to kiss her, slowly. 3. In all the hours they have spent together, Hugh Fisher and Bianca Madiero, they have never kissed on the mouth, and this is because of Abigail Dumont.
I'm engaged to be married, little one, he told her sadly the first time they met alone, as twilight settled over the cliffs to the west of Greyfriars. The wedding's set for Labor Day. Do you mind?
Of course not, she replied. I don't even know you, do I?
But we can be friends, can't we? I feel as if you and I can be friends, lifelong friends, tell each other things we can't tell other people. Everyone needs a friend like that, a friend you can sit with and be silent together and just understand each other, made from the same soul, do you know what I mean?
Of course I do.
Good then. I think you'll find I'm an excellent friend. If there's anything you need, just come to me. And if anyone tries to hurt you, Bianca, anyone at all, why— He'll have me to answer to.
She hadn't replied to that because her heart was so full. All words and even thoughts were crowded out. She only leaned her head against his shoulder tentatively, amazed at her own boldness, and he curled his arm about her and laid his hand on her hair and with his other hand took her fingers and laced them together with his fingers there upon his lap. They sat like this for many minutes, perhaps even an hour, and watched the sunset without saying a single word. At last he lifted their linked hands and kissed the seam where they joined, and said he would drive her back into the village now. She said no because someone would see, and so they walked instead, all the way down the hill, and said goodbye where Westcliff Road met Hemlock Street. He always said goodbye the same way, kissing the palm of her right hand, and she always closed her fist and ran down the street to the general store and the room she shared with her cousin Francisca on the third floor, knowing he kept watch until the darkness took her back, until the light in the window winked out. So it went all through the month of June, not every night, but 3 or 4 times a week. She knew when to slip out the door, because he would find a way to get her a note of some kind, hidden by mysterious means among the soup cans in the store, or tucked into the book she was reading, and once even inside the pocket of her pinafore apron. She thrilled to those clandestine messages, written in beautiful purple-black lettering, those signs of his cleverness and his all-powerful ways, and his regard for her and her reputation most of all. Because of course her aunt and uncle and cousins would not understand. They would think he was taking advantage of her, that she was giving herself sinfully to Hugh Fisher, that there was something sordid and unclean in these meetings. But Bianca knew otherwise. She believed in the purity of their love, because he never kissed her on the lips, not once, nor touched her in any way that was not reverent and guiltless. And she believed something else. She believed one day, when their love grew strong enough to overcome the demands of his family and his social station, he would renounce Miss Dumont and declare himself to Bianca, by word and deed. He would seal this promise with his lips. Then they would be married, and consummate their vows as God ordained. In her deepest heart, Bianca knew this to be true, and she prayed to God on her knees all June that this day would arrive soon, before the yearning inside her blood grew too clamorous to hold in check. 4. And now it's July, and he's kissing her at last, his mouth on her mouth. He finally understands how much he loves her, how he needs her and only her, how only Bianca among all women truly understands him. Tragedy has peeled the scales from his eyes and his heart. Having never kissed anyone on the lips before, she's startled at first by the strange taste of a man's mouth, by the silken quality, by the intimacy. Still, she accepts all these unfamiliar sensations without restraint or even doubt, because these are Hugh's lips she's receiving, Hugh's tongue, Hugh's love. And she and Hugh are made from the same soul. They are linked by fate and by God. She lifts her arms to encircle his neck, and he makes this groan like she's hurting him in some terrible way. In the next second, he lifts her into the air and carries her into the shade of the cabana, where he sets her gently on a cushion and sits back on his heels. The material of her dress falls away from her neck, and Bianca looks down and realizes that somehow, in the midst of their embrace, her buttons have come apart. She gasps and raises her hand, but Hugh pulls it away.
"No, let me see you, little one. I just want to see you, that's all. I won't hurt you, I promise."
He slides her arms from their sleeves and allows her bodice to fall around her waist. Beneath her camisole, her breasts are tight and swollen, and she crosses her arms over them. But he will have none of this modesty of hers. He takes each hand by the wrist and pulls them apart, sighing a little. Or maybe that's just the heightened pace of his breath. He slides his thumbs across her bosom and up to her shoulders, and one by one he takes the straps of her camisole and eases them down her arms, as he did with the sleeves of her dress. And just like that, Bianca finds herself absolutely bare before him, all the way to her waist. She looks down in dismay. Her breasts are so naked, so sinfully large and round, and Hugh's gaping at them, mouth parted. Bianca has to fist her hands behind her back to stop her own arms from shielding against his gaze, and in doing so her spine arches, creating the exact opposite effect, as if she's offering herself up to him. So Hugh takes one in each hand and sort of weighs them like fruit and says in an awed whisper,
"Do you know, Bianca, do you have any idea how perfect you are?"
Bianca shakes her head slowly.
It's like I've never seen a woman before now. Are you actually Eve, my love? Are you Eve, and I'm Adam, and this is Eden?
She tries to laugh at this blasphemy, although Hugh's face is heavy and serious. He reaches forward and takes her hands between his fingers.
Do you love me, little one?
Yes, Hugh, I love you.
Do you trust me?
Yes, yes.
I am sort of drunk, you know. Been drinking since dawn. Fell asleep drinking the night before.
I know.
She slips her hand from his fingers, lays it on the back of his head, and looks steadily into his unsteady eyes. There is an instant of connection, of understanding and perhaps forgiveness, before he lowers his mouth to the tips of her breasts, kissing and then suckling like an infant. How strange. Hard and then gentle and then hard again, pulling as if he's trying to draw milk from her. She doesn't object when he puts his hand under her dress and climbs like a spider up her leg, although she jumps as his finger reaches the edge of her knickers and slides right up underneath them to touch the wicked place at the junction of her legs, where the devil lives. Hugh lifts his head from her breast and whispers,
"Shh, let me touch you a little. Just touch you. You're so soft in there, little one, little love. You feel so good on my finger."
She stares into his eyes, which seem to be having trouble focusing. She cannot stop him, she realizes. She doesn't even want to stop him. After all, this is Hugh's finger touching her. And isn't he made from the sun? Isn't he her Apollo on Earth? Doesn't she trust Hugh more than anyone in the world? Can he not, by the divinity of his touch, drive away the devil from between her legs and turn sin into sacrament? All her life she's wanted this. She has craved some Apollo to anoint her with his love, to anoint her and only her. She has prayed to God on her knees, and now God is answering her prayer at last. She kisses Hugh's forehead, because she can't reach his lips, and he starts to fold her dress with both hands. Her thin, cheap dress of clumsily printed flowers, orange and pink, all the way up her legs in wide, deliberate tucks, until they form a kind of sash around her waist. From there, it's only a small distance to her belly, against which the ribbons of her knickers lie, waiting to be untied, which he does. The knickers are then discarded without ceremony, and he lifts himself above her and fumbles with his swimming trunks.
"Hold still," he says. "Hold still a second."
Bianca stiffens in panic under his looming weight. She digs her fingernails into his shoulders and thinks,
wait a moment, what is this?"
"Hold still,"
Hugh says again, and his fingers lodge between her legs. His knees spread her apart, and Bianca tries vainly to close herself.
"Please," she says, "please."
"Please no, or please yes?"
"Please, God."
Somehow, in the dizziness of her mind, they have become the same, God and Hugh, two faces of a single sun.
"Should I stop?" he pants.
She sinks her hips fearfully into the cushion and puts her hands on his bare, damp shoulders, either to push him away or to embrace him. She isn't sure.
"Be brave,"
she thinks.
"It's God's will, whatever happens. It is God's will. God is answering your prayer."
"That's right. Just for a second, darling," Hugh says. "I promise I won't. Ah, little one, I shouldn't. Oh, Christ, I can't stop. Don't move."
His speech descends into insensate mumbling. His fingers slip and pry, and then a blunt, thick, searing pressure assails her. Bianca gasps and tries to draw away, but there's nowhere to go, no possible escape. His hands have clamped on her hips, holding her in place against the cushion, and she screams as he pushes, grunts, pushes harder, and slides deeply into her, actually into her, so this forbidden part of his body is crammed tight into that forbidden part of her body, locking them together. Bianca feels like she might faint. A few minutes ago she was standing in the boxwoods, and now she's pinned on her back, virginity ruptured, in the very act of immoral intercourse with Hugh Fisher. Hugh Fisher! She's probably dreaming, that's it. She lies in shock beneath him and digs her fingers into his shoulders. But it can't be a dream, she thinks. He's too real. This thing between my legs, it's incontestable.
It's the rest of my life that's the dream, everything else I have dreamed until now.
Ah, little one, Bianca, sweet little love, I'm so sorry. Did I hurt you?
No, she shouts ferociously.
How does it feel?
She moves her lips, but there are no words for this sensation. To be so full and frightened and conscious of sin, to feel as if your world has overturned, to feel as if your love has transformed from a filmy, childish, fanciful thing into something carnal and solid that strains everything inside you until you might burst apart. So she just nods.
That's right. He bends his neck and kisses her. You're all right. It's just me, that's all. It's love, Bianca. This is what love is.
Still, she can't speak, so she makes a noise that sounds a little like a meowing cat. He starts to rock his hips against her hips, to slide out of her and then inside again. She tries not to cry out. She now understands it's a test, a sacrifice demanded by God, so she must acquit herself bravely and prove herself worthy of Hugh's love. But she can't help a little moan each time he pushes back in. After a minute or two, the rhythm builds to a furious pace like the stroke of a hammer splitting her apart, and another scream builds in her throat because it's too much to bear, whatever it is, too much pressure, too much pain, too much everything. But before the scream bursts free, Hugh shouts, "Ah, Christ!" and goes rigid, closes his eyes and locks his elbows. Like a statue, he arches above her, perfect in all respects, gleaming with sweat, wearing an expression of exquisite agony, and so utterly magnificent, so triumphant, she cannot breathe or think or feel. She cannot decide if she hates him or loves him. But this lasts only a few seconds before he crumples to her chest.
"Shh, it's all right," he gasps in her ear. "It's over now. It's done. Bianca, forgive me. It's all right."
She strokes his hair. The joints of her pelvis ache with his weight, spreading her open. He is hot, scorching hot, boiling over with a heat that astounds her. Hugh mumbles,
"God, I needed that."
Then he lifts his head.
"You're all right, little one?"
"Yes," she whispers.
"Don't be frightened. I'll take care of you, I promise. It's happened, that's all. It was always going to happen, I guess. You and me, Bianca. Fate."
He kisses her.
"Was I an awful beast? Do you still love me, little one?"
"Yes."
"Well, I love you, too. I'm crazy about you. I'm demented. Now more than ever. You must have known that already. I'll take care of you always, I promise. Whatever happens, you'll have anything you want. Just ask. You won't ever have to leave me."
Another kiss, and he lifts himself up on his hands. Their skin sticks briefly, as if reluctant to part, before the cool air rushes at last over Bianca's breasts and wet belly. He pulls himself out of her and rolls over on the cushion with a noise of immense relief. The sun strikes the cabana at such an angle as to cut him exactly in half, sunlit and shaded. Bianca supposes the same is true of her. She tries to move and cannot. She's too stiff and stunned, but she can at least turn her head to stare at Hugh, whose face addresses the stripes of the cabana's top, though his eyes are closed. For some time, they are both still, side by side on the cushion, recovering breath. Bianca feels something wet trickling between her legs, but she's too numb to comprehend its meaning entirely, except that it belongs to Hugh, that it endows their love with some kind of substance, with a permanence that cannot be undone.
"We're bound together now," Hugh says. "That's it."
"Yes," Bianca says for the third time. He turns his head to face hers. His expression is earnest, though his eyes are still unsteady. He touches her hair, her cheek, and tells her softly,
"You must promise never to leave me, Bianca. You must let me care for you always."
"Always," she agrees, and she means it. 5. Afterward, Hugh walks Bianca almost to her doorstep and kisses her softly, lingeringly, behind the shelter of a young elm. She slips through the garden door and into the back of Tio Manuelo's shop, thinking not that she is engaged to marry Hugh Fisher.
but that they are now actually man and wife before God, who hears the secret vows between lovers, who witnesses the ritual of their consummation, and who blesses them with the fruits of sacred union. This she believes with all her heart. 1951. Miranda Schuyler. 1. Over breakfast on the terrace, Isabel decided we should go to the festival. It was Sunday, the 22nd of July. I remember the date well. What festival? I naturally asked. She looked at me, eyebrows raised, as if I'd committed some act of unforgivable ignorance. The Countess answered for her. The Festival of the Holy Spirit, my dear, down in the village. The church puts it on each year. St. Mary's, I mean. Are you sure we'll be welcome? I doubt it, said the Countess. It's the last thing in the world they'd welcome, us turning up like tourists to gulp at them. Isabel buttered her toast from a pot buried in a bowl of ice. Oh, they won't care. It's not some kind of religious ritual, in case you're afraid of being made to kiss the Pope's ring or something. Just the part about the blessing of the fleet. But the rest is all fun and games. Blessing of the fleet? Do you mean the fishing fleet? They bless the boats? Isabel shrugged and looked out to sea. With her right hand, she reached for the cigarette case, and her gold bracelets clinked against the wrought iron table. Fishermen are superstitious. We had breakfast on the terrace most mornings, when it wasn't raining, which it usually wasn't. The weather through June continued warm and fair, except for the occasional drenching cloudburst, each day melting into the next. And when I think of those placid weeks between the wedding and the Festival of the Holy Spirit, I remember it as a rhythm, the beats of which consisted of breakfast and lunch and dinner, of morning tennis and afternoon swimming, of evening cocktails, of sunshine and moonshine, repeated at the same pace, the same speed, sunrise to sunrise. On weekends, the rhythm altered slightly, as new instruments joined us and the whole piece moved into a different key, but, well, you get the idea. That was the island's appeal. Human beings love rhythm. They love a beat to which they can tap their toes and dance sedately. So we danced, and we danced, and we drank, my God. As if the effects of rhythm were not stupefying enough, we pickled ourselves too, in careful, steady doses that maintained a certain desirable state of just lucid intoxication throughout the day. Maybe you couldn't have one without the other, I don't know. Maybe the rhythm would drive you crazy without the drink and vice versa. At first, I tried to resist the allure of a fresh, zinging Bloody Mary to move your blood in the morning, followed by regular injections of gin and tonic to keep you thriving throughout the day, followed by champagne cocktails, followed by wine at dinner, followed by some kind of nightcap. But it was like trying to resist the phases of the moon. They happened without your trying, half the time without your even noticing, carried along by the unceasing beat of mealtimes. The only thing I ever managed to resist that summer was bridge. Oh, and cigarettes. That was because of loyalty to my father, who had always hated the smell of tobacco smoke. Isabel had no such loyalties. She plucked a cigarette from its case, her fourth already this morning, and lit it swiftly with a gold lighter that matched her bracelet. The air was heavy and still, and she had to wave away a cloud of smoke in order to find me again. Well? She asked. It's a silly idea, said the Countess. In this heat, we could go sailing instead. Clay will take us out in his yacht, I'm sure.
I wasn't asking you, Abigail. I was asking Peaches.
Her blue eyes contained a familiar energy, which I tried to ignore. I poured myself another Bloody Mary from the glass pitcher. I think your mother's right. It's too hot. Let's go sailing or swimming instead. Isabel tossed down her toast and rose. The skin beneath her eyes was tired and bruised, and her mouth seemed to strain for words.
Then I guess I'll just have to go on my own, won't I?
Sit down, said the Countess. We're going sailing with the monks.
Not me. Not unless you're planning to kidnap me.
The Countess tapped each corner of her mouth with a napkin, sipped her coffee, and lit a cigarette. She liked a full breakfast, even in this heat, porridge followed by eggs and toast and fried ham, whereas Isabel ate only fruit in the morning. Fruit and coffee, that was all. Her mother frowned briefly at the end of her cigarette and looked across the water, toward the Fleet Rock lighthouse, sticking up from the still blue sea, as if to anchor the water to the sky.
"Very well," she said at last. "If you're so determined to make a fool of yourself, I'll just ring up the monks and see if Clay doesn't mind joining us there."
2. So that was how we came to put on our sundresses and our straw hats and our espadrille sandals and head down to the harbor that day. It was because of Isabel, who had probably made some arrangement with Joseph in the note I'd carried to him the day before, or during their clandestine meeting sometime past midnight at the swimming pool, which was shielded by boxwoods and therefore suitable for such rendezvous. I only knew because I'd kept my window open, such was the heat, and heard the telltale splashing, the suppressed giggles, the deep voice imploring quiet. At the time, I wondered how the Countess could possibly have remained ignorant. Maybe she wasn't, but she was also wise enough not to say anything. Isabel might have been in love with Joseph, but she was also addicted to the thrill of disobedience. She sent me as a go-between because it enhanced this thrill, and I obeyed her because I couldn't say no. I told myself that this was for Isabel's sake, better for me to remain inside this secret than out of it, the one sensible person to check their recklessness. But in truth, I was selfish. Joseph and I might spend only a few minutes talking when I delivered Isabel's notes, fragrant with her peculiar scent, but those few minutes were the truest minutes I spent all week. The instance of clarity amid the slumberous haze of an island summer, the moment I was truly awake, possibly even alive. And though I might have begged off this expedition to the blessing of the fleet, remaining at Greyfriars on principle, I did not. I chose to go too. I told myself that the Countess would need all the help she could get. When I arrived at the car, Isabel was already inside, applying her scarlet lipstick in confident strokes by the reflection of the rear-view mirror. She caught my approach over her shoulder and smiled.
"Well, jump in," she said. "Don't want to miss all the fun, do we?"
"Where's your mother?"
"Here."
The Countess came up behind me, dressed in a tangerine caftan and a hat so broad-brimmed and floppy I had to peer underneath to see her face, which was tense and resigned.
"I'll sit in the back, dear ones. I'm feeling a trifle malade."
How lithe we were, how tanned as we sped down the pale, curving road toward the village and the main harbor. The wind tumbling our hair, the sun striking the chrome points of Hugh Fisher's silver convertible. Isabel parked in the grass outside somebody's house and reached for her pocketbook and hat in the back seat. The Countess handed them to her, and I noticed as she fumbled to pluck another cigarette from its case, to light and to stick it in her mouth, that her fingers were unsteady. I opened the car door and pushed up the seat so the Countess could extract herself from the tiny space behind. I don't know how she fit to begin with. She had put on a pair of tinted glasses so I couldn't see the expression in her eyes, but I felt she was looking at me as she grabbed my hand to lever herself free from all the white leather and polished wood. She kept her grip as we started down the sidewalk, in the direction of the noise and the music nearer the water's edge, while Isabel walked slightly in front of us in a quick, eager stride. The hot air rose in waves from the ground. I think it might have been the hottest day of the year, and the marina had taken on a faintly rotten, salty odor, overcome now by the reek of frying fish. I saw the first clusters of men and women, the first stalls, and my pulse thumped in my neck. Isabel's stride lengthened, and I hurried to catch up with her. The Countess made a noise of exasperation. Somebody turned and saw us, a woman wearing a strange, colorful dress and headscarf, and she started and took the elbow of the man standing next to her, who wore a billowing white shirt and black knee breeches and a scarlet sash around his waist. So he looked, too, and pretty soon the whole group of them had fallen silent and staring, while Isabel and I made our way down the street toward the tendrils of smoke and the small brass band playing a tune I didn't recognize. As we passed the knot of men and women, Isabel raised her hand.
"Hello there! Scorching day, isn't it?"
There were answering nods and waves. We turned the corner of Hemlock Street, which ran along the scattered docks and shops that made up the marina of West Harbor, and everything had transformed from when I had seen it last, just a couple of days ago. Picnic tables covered the green, and stalls rose up alongside the road selling refreshments and wares, and everybody milled around in what I supposed to be some kind of Portuguese national costume. At the other end of the street, the docks and moorings were crammed with fishing boats, with fishermen laughing and talking and drinking. Now I felt the full weight of our intrusion, the hot shame of it. I walked bravely onward next to Isabel, weaving my way between knots of astonished people, children in ruffled clothes, elaborately embroidered, women radiant in red, and the men, baggy and vibrant, who nodded and smiled. Isabel greeted everybody by name, like they were old pals, like they came over daily for tennis or bridge. She hurried us toward a stall selling wine from wooden barrels and also homemade ice cream, and she bought 2 strawberry cones. Her mother refused one, the first time I had ever seen the Countess turn down something edible, which we ate on the bench outside the tackle shop. The awning overhead cast us partly in shade, and Isabel stretched out her golden legs to catch the sun. I licked the ice cream and asked her how she knew everybody so well.
"Let me see."
She ran her tongue around the edge of the cone, where the ice cream melted away in long pink trickles.
"There's Mrs. Menzies, who runs the post office. Her husband's that drunk fellow climbing into the boat, off the dock to the left. She's got a couple of sons. I don't know where they are. And that's old Santana with him. He runs the ferry on this side. His wife sells the tickets in summer. They had 7 or 8 children, and the last one moved to the mainland last year, I think. Becky Santana. Nice girl. Met a fellow working on the island for the summer and married him. That's Mrs. Costa and Mrs. Sweeney, gossiping together as usual. Their husbands are lobstermen. Frank Costa, that's her son, he gets seasick, so he's a groundskeeper over at the club. You get to know everybody, that's all, when you've lived here long enough."
The ice cream was melting all over my hand, faster than I could lap it up, requiring a certain amount of strategic concentration. I lost the train of names and made some kind of assenting noise to cover the lapse.
"Why, what do you think, Peaches? You think we just lounge about in our pretty houses and ignore everybody else? We're all family here on the island, you know. We're all in this together. If a hurricane strikes, why, you'd better hope you've got friends among the fishing fleet, because nobody at the club has the least idea how to survive without electricity for a month, let alone rescue some poor soul washed out to sea."
"Like Vargas," I said under my breath, but she heard me anyway.
"Yes, like Joseph."
She said his name in such a way that I forgot my ice cream and glanced to my side. Isabel slouched back against the bench, red-striped sundress hanging from her long straight legs, while her narrowed eyes peered over the curve of her pink ice cream scoop to some point in the distance. I followed the line of her vision to its object, all the way down the wide wooden dock directly opposite, in the center of the harbor, where a group of men stood in resplendent costume, and the most resplendent of all was a slim, wiry, long-legged man who stood just to the side, wiping the wooden trim of his lobster boat with a white kerchief. His hat and his short black jacket were lavishly embroidered in gold, and the scarlet sash dangled from his waist like a spill of blood. As I watched, as we both watched, Isabel and I, while the ice cream melted down our hands and made them sticky, he straightened and turned to the man nearest him and made some joke to which they both laughed. I thought how hot he must feel under the blazing sun in that black woolen jacket. All of them, those men wearing their quaint, breathtaking costumes. They must have been sweating through their shirts. In the middle of their laughter, a woman started down the dock and approached them, dressed in black and scarlet like the others, gold embroidery, looking like she meant to scold them for irreverence. I couldn't see her face. I thought it must be Vargas's wife, Joseph's mother.
And that old woman over there,
Isabel continued, reading my mind,
the one coming up to Joseph right now, that's his grandmother.
His grandmother? He never mentioned a grandmother, I said, without thinking. The Countess, who'd sat quietly throughout all this, looking extraordinarily ill-placed in her bright, flowing florals, put down her cigarette and drawled,